Good morning and welcome to Take AIM, Accuracy in Media's talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories the mainstream media ignore. I'm Roger Aronoff, the editor of Accuracy in Media and of the AIM Report, which you can sign up for at our website, aim.org. You can also sign up there to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. We have an outstanding guest today. He's a 36-year Navy veteran, retired Admiral James Lyons, Jr. Admiral Lyons was Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet and the senior U.S. military representative to the United Nations. He is President and CEO of Lyon Associates, which provides strategic consulting in the areas of foreign policy and security affairs. And he's a columnist, and we've been seeing his columns in the Washington Times and other places across the internet, and it's been some very interesting things he's been writing about, particularly this Benghazi story and other things that we'll get into as well. Good morning, Admiral Lyons. Thank you for joining us today on Take AIM.
Well, it's nice to be here.
Well, there's so much going on, and we'll get into it quickly. But first, I just want to thank you for your incredible service to this country. People should go to the website, Lyon, LYONLLC.com. You can read his biography and read his columns, and definitely urge you to do that. And just before we came on the air, I mentioned to you that last year I visited the National Museum of the Pacific War in, of all places, Fredericksburg, Texas, the home of Admiral Nimitz. It's an amazing museum, and you mentioned you haven't been there yet, and, you know, I'm sure you could tell the stories that they're telling in there, and it's really an amazing
well,
place.
Well, Nimitz was a great leader and a great man. Let me tell you, one thing about Nimitz, in today's Navy, he never would have made it. He ran his destroyer aground as a commander. They would have crucified him today.
Oh, wow.
It gives you something to think about.
Interesting. Well, what was your most memorable experience as Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet?
Well, Soviet Navy was in full bloom then, so that was one of our primary focuses, and how we managed to raise the level of deterrence out there and keep the Soviets off balance, and how we were able to bring the Soviet ballistic missile submarine fleet under control. And it's really through the dedication and hard work of our personnel who were really on the front lines, who were able to execute in a way that assured us of achieving success. And one of the most interesting aspects, we did the first humanitarian cruise of the hospital ship Mercy to the South Pacific in 1987. And I was in Manila in June, and this is when Cory Aquino just took over from Marcos.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew she needed a quick success. And I was looking at how we could help her. And she said her highest priority was to raise the quality of life of the man in the street. I said, what better way than to give him his health? And I proposed to Minister of Defense Enrile and then Chief of Staff Ramos that they join with us and we deploy a hospital ship to the Philippines. It was still one of the supercarriers that was being converted, tankers, the super tanker carriers that was being converted to a hospital ship. And the completion, it completed in December of 86. We had it outfitted and manned and on station in the Philippines the end of April. Unheard of. We had 50% U.S. doctors and nurses and 50% Filipino. The U.S. contingent was made up of Army, Navy, Air Force, and public health doctors and officials. I estimated we could treat 1,000 people a day. In 9 weeks, we treated over 64,000 people. Down in Zamboanga, the heart of the Muslim uprising in the Philippines, we had that ship in there. We had them lined up 7,000 in line on the streets waiting to get treatment. And to this day, they've never forgotten that.
What a great legacy. That's tremendous. Does that sort of operation still exist today?
Oh, yeah. You see, I wanted to institutionalize it at the time because the ones who were fighting me the hardest were the Navy and Navy medicine. And Tsunami in 2004 in Indonesia, I called Vern Clark, who was the CNO at the time, and I had John Howe, the CEO of Project Hope. And I told Vern what we did with the Mercy in the Philippines, and we had an opportunity to do the same thing in responding to the Indonesian tragedy. And I put the team, because we were concerned, you know, we were in the war in Iraq, and we had problems with, availability of doctors and nurses. And anyway, Project Hope provided the volunteer doctors and nurses, and it became a tremendous success. Before that Mercy deployment to Indonesia, 20% of the people in that province were 80% were against the United States. After the deployment, 80% were pro-U.S.
That's fantastic. Yeah, what a great face for America to be presenting.
And we still, humanitarian cruises now are institutionalized in Navy policy. So this goes on every year in different parts of the world. It's one of the great ways to win the hearts and minds of people and to show the best of America.
Well, I agree, and that's a great story. So let's move on to some of the issues of the day. And you have been a persistent critic of how the administration has handled the attack on our special mission compound in Benghazi. And we had the couple of reports, including the Accountability Review Board. And then yesterday we had Secretary of State Clinton's testimony. Do you feel we've gained a more clear picture of what really happened?
Not in the least. You're still getting the smoke screen. And I must say that, quote, independent Accountability Review Board, from my perspective, was like having the mafia investigate a crime scene.
Okay. And explain why. That was the one headed by Thomas Pickering and Mullen?
Pickering, he's the chairman of the International Crisis Group, which is a Soros-funded group. So, and plus with his long career in the State Department, I wouldn't consider that to be foremost in getting an independent review. What really needs to happen here? And you can see it yesterday in the testimony of Secretary Clinton. You're never going to get the true story until you appoint a special prosecutor, put the people under oath to find out what actually went on. And the House has that authority, and I think they're the only ones today that I think, if they have the courage to do so, to stand up and appoint a special prosecutor and get to the bottom of this mess.
Okay. Well, yes, that would be very useful. It would be considered highly political, but
that's what it's all about here.
Exactly. I want to give you first the opportunity to clarify a quote that has been widely attributed to you that was on numerous websites. You were said to have told the Washington Examiner that Benghazi was actually a bungled kidnapping attempt to be perpetrated upon Ambassador Stevens, and that was going to be part of a hostage exchange for the blind sheikh, Omar Abdel Rahman, who sits in jail in the U.S. for his role in planning the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993. I'm sure you've seen that. So what is...
I appreciate the opportunity to clarify because, first of all, I've never talked to the Washington Examiner. Where this came up, I was on the Lou Dobbs show, and somebody must have copied down or from that show submitted a report or something to the Washington Examiner. Lou asked me, what do I think went on? What did I suspect happened? And I said, well, if I had to speculate, I believe this was a bungled attack.
Kidnapping.
A kidnapping attack to kidnap Ambassador Stevens and hold him in exchange for the blind sheikh. And, you know, there's been a lot of pressure, certainly from Morsi. That's one of his objectives, to get the blind sheikh released. Now, again, he asked me, you know, what I thought. I said, I speculated, because nothing else made sense to me. We know that Ambassador Stevens was concerned over his safety there. I mean, why would he stay there? Certainly, first of all, why was he even there on the night of 9/11? You have the significance of the date of 9/11. Most places, people hunkered down. Then we had a lot of not only tactical but strategic warning of this attack, and we can get into that now if you'd like.
Yes, why don't you give us some of that?
And let me say, from my viewpoint, there was both strategic and tactical warning. In the previous June, we had both the British consulate and the International Red Cross close their offices up due to the assassination attempt on the British consul general and other assassinations. We had the bombing outside our special mission compound on the 6th of June. On the 16th of August, the cable was put out that, look, in a determined attack, we cannot defend this compound. And they requested additional security assistance. They didn't get any. The day of the attack, the Blue Mountain security manager, that afternoon, sensed there was something wrong. He put out an alert on both his radios and cell phones. Prior to that, we know one of the policemen who was assigned to guard the compound was seen taking pictures of the inner layout of the compound. We found a memo later by Ambassador Stevens saying he found this to be most troubling. We know, according to reports, reliable reports, that roadblocks were set up at least 3 hours before the attack. We know the consul general, who was the last person to see Ambassador Stevens, had to go through those roadblocks. When the columnist Diane West interviewed the Turkish consul general, she asked him about that, and he said, well, I didn't notice anything unusual, which is somewhat strange. And then we had there was a Brit security team that, through prior arrangements, would drop off or pick up equipment from the compound. So there was more than ample evidence and signals.
Warnings
that something is not right. And knowing that he feared for his safety, why would he stay there? It makes no sense to me. That's why I speculated perhaps this was supposed to be part of a kidnapping hostage situation, holding him in exchange for the blind sheikh. Because killing Ambassador Stevens made no sense to me, since he was the great facilitator in funneling the arms to the rebels, to other militias, many of which were al-Qaeda affiliated, who had been fighting our troops in Iraq. So why would you kill the golden goose? It made no sense to me.
All right. Well, number of people.
And there's one other thing I've mentioned.
Yeah, go ahead.
The leader of al-Qaeda, the day before, on 10 September, put out a video calling for revenge on the U.S. for the killing of a key al-Qaeda leader in Libya by the CIA. That was another when we're talking about videos, that's the video that everybody should have focused on, not
right.
the 14-minute string of the anti-Islamic string of vehicle that nobody had ever seen.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, so just to be clear then, so you don't have inside information, no one really, that's just sort of your thinking, what are the possibilities?
Well, I'm taking this from the reports, that have been in the public media.
No, I understand that part.
I've had no inside connection on this.
Right.
I've talked with knowledgeable people. One of my old friends, Bing West, who has written extensively about this, and certainly over our campaigns, and you know, it just what went on really is a tragedy mm-hmm. that I believe could have been prevented,
right?
And certainly minimized.
Now that September 10th video that you referred to from the Al Qaeda chief, that was Ayman al-Zawahiri.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, release that. So, well, and then you also referred to the August 16th cable. Well, yesterday we heard Secretary Clinton say that she never saw those pleas for help that, you know, out of the million.
That's only one cable.
Right.
We had Lieutenant Colonel Wood and his 16-man security force, which was at the embassy in Tripoli. They were there in August. They had been there for a number of months to beef the security. The ambassador requested that they stay. They wanted to stay, yet they were denied and yanked out. The pleas for additional security were ignored, denied. Now, I find it difficult to accept that, what's her name, the Assistant Secretary for Security, Charlene
Lamb.
On her own, turned down all those repeated requests. You know,
right.
You have to ask yourself, what was the political agenda they were trying to create here, that the Arab Spring has been such a wonderful, great success in Libya, that we can now stand down and we can rely on the 17th February Martyrs Brigade to provide the security, which incidentally has close affiliation with Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. So,
right.
You know, none of this really, if you step back and analyze it, makes any sense.
Well, there's a couple things. You mentioned Charlene Lamb when she gave her testimony a while back. There were two things that were brought up yesterday, I believe, by Dana Rohrabacher. One was that she had, Ms. Secretary Clinton and others are saying, is, look, the House Republicans blocked $300 million from security, and that was part of the problem. And the other thing that Charlene Lamb was saying was that she was watching in real-time video as this was happening, and Ms. Clinton, you know, said that wasn't the case. And so, I mean, there's complete contradiction there between what these two are saying.
Yeah.
Do you have any insight into that?
Well, first of all, Charlene Lamb is not a security expert. She just put in that job, so she really had no background on how to provide security and so forth for our embassies. So that she really was not qualified for the job. This smokescreen of the withheld funding, you had teams in Libya who wanted to stay, and they wouldn't let them stay. That doesn't have anything to do with the funding, this withholding funding, and therefore we couldn't put in additional resources. They were there.
So one motive, you speculate this could have been the setup for a kidnapping attempt. I mean, otherwise, yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine a scenario. Why would they turn down these requests for added security, or why would they send people who were there who wanted to stay? I mean, how high up does this go, in your opinion?
You know, when you get into the the actual day of the attack, where everybody was basically witnessing through the video, watching the attack go on and listening to the cries for help. I think this goes well up the food chain.
Right.
And we can get into the what resources could have been brought to bear that weren't, and why
well,
not.
Let's touch on that, because this is something that I've followed and written about too, because Secretary of Defense Panetta, early on when he was asked about this, he said, and I quote here, he said, the basic principle, you know, that when why no troops were sent in to attempt to save or rescue Ambassador Stevens and the others, his answer was this, and this is a quote, the basic principle is that you don't deploy forces into harm's way without knowing what's going on, without having some real-time information about what's taking place, and as a result of not having that kind of information, we felt very strongly that we could not put forces at risk in that situation. But then he later indicated that he actually gave verbal approval to have the Marine teams based in Rota, Spain, to come there to Tripoli and Benghazi. I mean, so, and then there was the Marine unit that you wrote about stationed in Sigonella, Italy, and none of them went, but, you know, it looks like Panetta has changed his story on this.
Well, I think the initial was a little, all those comforting words that we don't want to put our forces at risk. We had people at risk. They were crying for help.
Right.
And in a situation, you go with the resources you have available. And in this particular case, we did have that 130-man Marine Force recon team sitting there in Sigonella. Even if I only got 50 of them over there, that would have been significant in turning the situation around. We may not have been able to save the ambassador, but we certainly could have saved those other two SEALs that were over on the annex. And there's another tactic that we've used over the years very successfully in dispelling mobs and scenes like we witnessed there in Benghazi, and that's we had F-16 aircraft that could have been there within a matter of hour or two. And what you have them do is you have them make a low pass over the scene in full afterburner, and it has a telling effect. It really gets their attention. Plus, with the equipment that they have in their cockpit, they could have been utilized to take some offensive action if we had the courage to do so.
So,
you know, and there's another thing here, too.
Yes.
You know, that the independent review board made a statement that, made some requests to embassies. But let me tell you this. I know of no request that was made to the Turkish consul generals, the Turkish consulate, the Italian consulate, or that Brit security team that was in Benghazi. All have said they received no requests for support. They went on to say, if we were requested, we would have provided it.
It's really incredible. I think the sort of smokescreen that you referred to that Secretary Clinton was throwing out there yesterday, part of it was, well, look at what all was going on. All of our embassies that were under siege that day. In Egypt, in Tunisia, and I guess in Yemen, and so that they were looking at dealing with all of those situations, and that I think suggesting they were just kind of overwhelmed by what was going on, and maybe didn't act right. So this sort of also led up to this scenario where Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin was asking her about why they persisted in telling this story about the anti-Islamic video that you referred to a few minutes ago. And her answer was, she said, quote, what difference does it make? She said, at this point, whether it was because of a protest or it was because guys were out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans. So I ask you, Admiral Lyons, what difference does it make?
Well, let me answer it this way. Richard Nixon found out what the difference is when you lie to the American public. And in his lie, it was only a bungled burglary attempt. Nobody got killed. In this case, we had four Americans murdered. Furthermore, we knew right within a matter of hours that this was a determined, pre-planned terrorist attack. So you have to ask yourself, why perpetuating this lie for almost 2 weeks? Why did she participate in that video, at taxpayers' expense, I might add, that was sent all around Pakistan, condemning the 14-minute stringer anti-Islamic video that nobody had seen? And certainly with our embassy in Cairo, they had put out their great apologies the day before, and really there wasn't anybody in our embassy, and the Egyptians were able to quickly restore order there, which in Libya, you had no such situation. You have really no functioning central government in Libya. It's really in total disarray. The Arab Spring there has fostered a group of al-Qaeda-affiliated militias that have now been made available all Qaddafi's military equipment, much of which we're seeing show up in Mali, and certainly may have been part of equipping the group that did the terrorist attack in Algeria.
Another thing that is really baffling is that for over 3 weeks after this happened, there was no FBI that arrived at the crime scene to go through it, see what forensic evidence
right.
there might have been, see anything. I mean, that just seems like such an incredible oversight.
Let me comment on that. Because
yes.
I want to go back to the last point we
okay.
were discussing.
Okay.
And that is, you know, in perpetuating this lie, we also had administration officials lying to congressional committees. That's a felony. So what difference does it make? It makes all the difference in the world. You cannot flaunt the truth here and just walk away from it and basically tell the American public to stuff it. That's
mm-hmm.
not acceptable. The point on the organizing the two Marine anti-terrorist teams in Rota, that was good to go ahead and stand them up. What I find incomprehensible, the first team, it took them 23 hours to go a few hundred miles from Rota to Tripoli. I could go around the world in 23 hours. So, you know, that makes absolutely no sense to me. And the fact that they stood down the second team, which was supposed to go to our special mission compound in Benghazi, and the excuse being, well, all the Americans were out of there, makes no sense to me, since this was American territory. That compound should have been immediately secured, and that certainly that Marine team was quite capable of doing that. Had they done that, the FBI would have been immediately able to access that scene and gain valuable information. Plus, we would have stopped the looting. And in this sense, I find that compound had to have certain classified communications equipment. I can't believe they did not have communications equipment. And you have to ask, what happened to that equipment? Who has it today? And I know Secretary Clinton made this grand flowing statement, well, there was nothing classified in the compound. I find that incomprehensible.
Yeah, I mean, how do they know? Look, CNN is walking through there, found his logbook,
yeah,
you know.
Of course.
And then 3 weeks later, the Washington Post went in and found other things that no one had even touched or picked up. I mean, it's incredible.
What was it they wanted to keep our people from seeing there?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the question, though, but they didn't secure the place to keep reporters from just walking through and picking up whatever they could find.
Yeah, well, they couldn't stop the reporters from going in, but they certainly could stop our military from going in.
Right. So the question, I guess, is where this goes from here. Let me bring up one other aspect, because Frank Gaffney of the Center for Security Policy and others have speculated that really what was going on here was, and you made reference to this, but that the weapons that we had supplied to the Libyans who were fighting to overthrow Gaddafi, that all these weapons or many of these were now being supplied to the so-called rebels in Syria, you know, some
right.
who were Al-Qaeda and all that, and that so this was sort of a gun-walking, fast and furious gun-walking operation into Syria to other Al-Qaeda people, and this is what's being sort of covered up here. Do you have an opinion on that?
Let me put it this way. I agree with Frank's statement there. We know that it was being funded both by Qatar and Saudi Arabians. What was going on would make Iran-Contra look like child's play.
So where is Congress? Why? I mean, look, the Republicans control the House. Do they not have access to this information? Do they lack the guts, the vision? What is?
Well, I think really what has to happen, the House has to have the courage to appoint a special prosecutor. We still don't even know how Ambassador Stevens died.
Right.
You've not been able to interview any of the people that were rescued from Benghazi. You've got to get these people in, put them under oath, and find out the true story of what went on. Nothing less to me is acceptable.
Well, a number of people, for instance, Ralph Peters yesterday was on Fox and criticizing the Republicans for sort of not having prepared well. First of all, it's difficult when you each get 5 minutes to ask questions, and you know, she can take up three or four of those minutes, you know, with answering your first question. So it's absolutely.
Anyway, since she had a month to prepare for her performance,
right,
which really was a fluff show from my viewpoint.
Yes. So, let's touch on a couple other things sort of related in a way. One thing is the Arab Spring in general, and now we see that we're about to supply these advanced F-16 fighter planes and these Abrams tanks to Egypt, which Egypt is now controlled by the Muslim Brotherhood. And Morsi,
exactly.
And we know what he thinks, I mean, of Israel. And, you know, the question, the obvious question that hangs over this is who are these weapons to be used against? And why are we doing this? What is your sort of overall opinion of how this Arab Spring is going and then this act in particular?
Well, the Arab Spring is a total disaster. We have uncontrolled militias, certainly throughout Libya, Mali. You've got the situation in Syria. You look at Iraq. Iraq is far from any streaming success. The major weapon systems, the F-16s and the Abram tanks, the 200 Abram tanks that are being transferred, all that commitment was done with Mubarak.
Right.
So to me, since they threw out Mubarak, I would have canceled the deal. Why go forward with it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the theory goes that Morsi played the role of this great peacemaker when he got
wait a minute. Great
Hamas to stop.
Please spare me. He's the guy who endorses Hamas. Hamas
right.
is a wing of the Muslim Brotherhood in Gaza. It is their group. So this great peacemaker is
right.
just pure hogwash. We got to take our head out of the sand. The Muslim Brotherhood penetration in this country is really unconscionable. They've been able to penetrate in almost every one of our government agencies. You see it reflected down in the administration's directive where we have to purge all our training manuals and instructors on anything that purports the truth about Islam. Anything that is considered anti-Islamic must be purged, and our instructors that don't fall in line find themselves with new orders elsewhere. We have the Organization of Islamic Cooperation that our great Secretary of State has endorsed and which impinges on our First Amendment rights of freedom of expression, and that, and the administration is embracing this, that we leave it up to the, 57 or 58 Islamic states that make up that organization. They determine what they consider to be insulting to Islam, and therefore they can impose sanctions or bring you to trial or whatever on this. None of this makes any sense to me.
So I have to ask you, because you cannot be the only military man, and obviously you're an ex-military man, you're retired, is after your name, as admiral and head of the Pacific Fleet and all that, but where are the military leaders today? Is there anyone, you know, you think of some of the people, Singh Lab, who stepped down, and people who speak from, you know, their conscience, and I'm sure there's others who look at this the same way you do, but are obviously...
Well,
restrained.
Unfortunately, political correctness has infected almost every level of military leadership, and it's very clear that the message today is you go along to get along.
Mm-hmm. Do you sense anything boiling up under the surface? Anyone that you know or you hear about that is...
Well, we had certainly the reports in the last day or two of our CENTCON commander, who seems to be forced to retire several
Mattis.
Months early, right, on his views on Iran, and which I certainly share. I've been... you know, in the forefront, I've been trying to remove the Iranian Khomeini regime for over 30-some-odd years.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, during the Carter administration, I was the director of political military affairs for the JCS. And when they took over our embassy, the chairman asked me, what can we do? I said, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to take Karg Island, which was their main oil exporting depot. We could have walked right in with our Navy SEALs, and that would have had them by the gonads, and we would have given them 24 hours to get out of our embassy, or their main oil exporting depot would be ashes. During the Reagan administration, the blow-up of our, you know, and what happened, we didn't do anything, so they continued with the kidnapping, assassinations, and so on, and culminating in the Reagan administration, where they blew up our embassy, and then we have proof positive the orders for the Marine barracks bombing came right from Tehran. Mm-hmm. We had our planes loaded. We were ready to totally wipe out the Islamic Amal. We were going to take that Sheikh Abdullah barracks above Baalbek and make it look like a plowed cornfield in Kansas. We would have been in and out in a minute and a half, and we could never get authority to launch. The one who prevented that launch was none other than our own Secretary of Defense. Why, I've never been able to figure out.
Were you referring to Weinberger?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
And not only once, but twice. And I got this from Bud McFarlane, who was the National Security Advisor, and he's allowed me to quote him on this, and I've done so in several articles.
And did it go to Reagan above that? I mean, was he given the chance to overrule?
Let me tell you what happened. I had personally briefed Weinberger in his office on the strike, along with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and all of that. And I had been working with CIA on this, and Casey had called me out to Langley and said, look, if we find out who did it, would I make up the plans to take him out? And I said, of course. Long story short, identified the group, We drew up the plans. We had the planes loaded. I had Brief Weinberger in his office. We had the meeting, National Security Council meeting with the president. And at that meeting, Weinberger told the president, well, I think there are still Lebanese army troops in those barracks, which was totally false because the Islamic Amal, with the help of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, took over those barracks on the 16th of September, 1983. So the president quite properly turned to Bill Casey and said, Bill, what about that? Well, Bill had just returned from a trip, and I knew it was, he insisted on taking the meeting. John McMahon, who was the deputy director, should have taken the meeting, but was overruled. Then, of course, Casey didn't know, so the president said, go back and sort it out. And the next day, lo and behold, no, there were no Lebanese army troops in those barracks. But this time, according to Bud McFarlane, Weinberger is waving his arms that if we go ahead with this strike, we're going to lose all our Arab friends and da-da-da-da-da. And he threw enough smoke in the air, and we never could get the authority to brief, to launch. And the next time came when we were going to do a combined strike. The French, you know, lost 54 or 55 of their military during that same day, October 23rd, 1983. And they wanted to retaliate. And I'm told by Bud McFarlane that the president approved the combined strike. I have Jerry Tuttle, who was the carrier strike group commander. In fact, what we did, we carried our strike plans to the carriers because I knew then the Soviets were reading our comms. And this was long before Walker surfaced. Mm-hmm. But I won't go into the background how I knew that.
Okay.
Anyway, the president approved the combined strike and Weinberger wouldn't issue the order. McFarlane called him up and said, what's going on? And he never got a satisfactory answer out of it because, you know, you would have thought he would have been fired on the spot. But according to Bud, he used his kitchen cabinet association with the president and nothing happened. Those two events really launched when we didn't do anything. If you recall, when we didn't respond to 241 Marines being killed, that became Osama bin Laden's rallying cry. That the Americans can't stop suffer casualties, they will cut and run. And in the perception of the Arab world, that's exactly what we did.
Mm-hmm. Paper tigers, yeah. So today, our posture in relation to Iran and Israel, when, first of all, what the signal being sent by these arms being shipped to Egypt, as well as the appointments of Kerry, Hagel, and Brennan as President Obama's national security team. What does this say about our posture toward both Iran and Israel?
Well, certainly, if I were Iran, I'd be thrilled to death with those appointments.
Why is that?
Because none of them are for taking any military action against Iran, which is giving them clear sailing for the development of their nuclear weapon capability. And, you know, it isn't just their capability in Iran. You got to look at what they've done in Latin America. We have Iranian operational missile bases today in Venezuela, fully up and operational. They've been able to accomplish what the Soviet Union tried to do in Cuba in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
And we have cities in the United States today which are under the threat umbrella of those missiles that are in Venezuela. It needs to be addressed. In fact, they should be forced out of there post-haste, either taken out or we'll take them out. I don't see that happening.
And what about Israel? What is the message to Israel with these appointments and these actions and...
It certainly cannot be encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have to look at themselves to become more self-reliant. And regretfully, none of this contributes to maintaining the peace through a strong deterrence. When you show weakness, which we're doing, it only encourages those who would do us harm. I mean, how many times we have to go down this path to really come to our senses on this. Here we had four people killed in Americans killed in Benghazi. What do we do? Absolutely nothing. There are training camps. We know there are training camps out there that these militias were using. I wanted to destroy them. This idea of, well, we got to respect the sovereignty of Libya, not when our people are being murdered and held under duress. There is no, quote, functioning government in Libya from what I can see.
Well, you had another column last week called Where Are the Carriers? And you wrote about the Navy's power projection, in other words, their ability to deploy and maintain superiority at what you call the points of entry, wherever required. And you say we're down to having only 9 such carriers in a total of 287 ships when we should have more like 350. What's going on here? Is it strictly budgetary? Does it represent a strategic or philosophical shift?
There are several things. Budget certainly is one key factor. We had the decommissioning of the Enterprise after 45 years of really wonderful service, not only for the Navy but for the country. And we have the Abraham Lincoln undergoing a 4-year overhaul. So that took you from the 11 carriers, operational carriers we had, down to 9. And the Gerald Ford is being delayed through a very innovative catapult system that's being placed on it. So that is not operationally available. So to maintain, the Navy's been forced to maintain 2 carriers in the Middle East, primarily one to provide close air support in Afghanistan and to be able to respond to any provocations by Iran. I see no reason why the Navy has to have carriers to provide close air support in Afghanistan when I believe this role can be fulfilled by the Air Force and the Marine Air Wings. Certainly with our drawdown, they have sufficient assets to take care of that. And with regard to Iranian provocation, you know, when you keep a carrier boring a hole in the same geographic location, you lose the impact of what that carrier strike group means and what our intentions are. You just become part of the background. We fell into this trap during the Carter administration. We kept wearing our ships, aircraft, and people out, and we didn't do anything. We just kept boring holes out there. So you really, you need to keep your potential enemies off balance. You don't do that by being static. You need to be able to move those carriers and keep the other side guessing on exactly what your intentions are and how you're going to respond. And when you have to come into an area with a carrier strike group, that has a special meaning. That means we've just signaled our intent and that we have a primary interest in what's going on in this area, and we are going to be a major player.
Just a couple more things here I'd like you to comment on. The Law of the Sea Treaty keeps lurking right behind the scenes, and for years with Senator Lugar there, they were always looking for an opportune moment to get it passed in the Senate and ratified. And what is your opinion? You've obviously been out there on the front lines.
Yeah, the Law Treaty is something. Why would you turn over your sovereignty to a UN-type committee where you have no veto power and you know you're going to be outvoted 40-1?
Right.
It makes absolutely no sense to me. You're seeing this being displayed by China out in the South China Sea, making their illegal claims to basically the entire South China Sea, even though I believe they have signed up to the Law of the Sea Treaty, but they will not submit. They did it with an exemption. They said anything they consider part of their territory, they will not submit to the Law of the Sea Councils for resolution. So you can see where that is leading. And actually, another case here, we've had this Laura C. Tribunal, which has impacted, what was it, on Ghana, that involved telling them what they could do or not do in their tributaries,
right,
which are clearly territorial waters. I mean, this. So why would we subject ourselves to such a situation? It makes no sense to me. We enjoy and support the freedom of the high seas. We've done it since our founding, and it is recognized international law, and there's no reason for us to submit ourselves to a UN council that clearly is against our interests.
And you mentioned China and their sort of resurgent naval power, and President Obama made reference to us becoming more of an Asian Pacific nation. And what do you see happening there in over the next few years? And what's the big concern? And is our Navy in that part of the world up to the task? Are we prepared for it strategically? What do you?
Well, the theater is evolving to more into what they consider called the air sea battle. It's primarily United States Navy and U.S. Air Force to project U.S. power into the region, and clearly we're strapped. We touched on it previously, the budget sequestration. We have an anemic shipbuilding program. Admiral Greenwich, and I support him in getting relief from the two-carrier commitment to the Middle East. That certainly is key, and key to our maintaining our flexibility and ability to influence events as they occur. You know, always when there's a crisis, one of the first questions out of the White House is, where are the carriers? And so the impact of the carrier certainly must remain foremost. And if so, our shipbuilding plan right now, if in effect it's able to, will only give us 292 ships within the next decade, when we ought to be at 350. And really, over 20% of that 292 ships will be the literal combat ship. And the most recent test and evaluation report really was a disaster for the Navy because, as I've said many times, this is a ship we're spending several hundreds of millions of dollars to produce, and it has no offensive or defensive capability. Aside all the fall for all, this is a program that should be canceled, and we should be building a ship with a fighting potential.
And one more question I want to ask you. Have you seen this movie Zero Dark Thirty? Have you had a chance to see that yet?
No, I haven't seen it.
Yeah. Well, what is your take on the killing of Osama bin Laden?
I have no problem with that.
Yes.
I understand we could have carried it out earlier. And I'm told that Secretary Panetta was key in forcing that decision.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully that was the case. But, you know, we've had situations in the past where we could have changed the course of history. For example, in 1996, Sudan offered to turn over Osama bin Laden and his key hierarchy during the Clinton administration, and he turned it down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ambassador Carney,
really,
I remember, yeah.
The 9/11 should be hung around his neck. Had we gone ahead and taken that offer, I would suspect we never would have had a 9/11.
Right. I think you're right. That was a key moment. And yeah, Ambassador Carney, I believe, he talked about that very specific offer was made. And then, of course, there were a couple of other chances to take him out, and they didn't want the collateral damage that would have accompanied it.
This great concern for collateral damage. How about the collateral damage that's been done to Americans all over the world, including New York City?
Right.
That's You know, let's get our heads screwed on. This great concern doesn't impress our adversaries. Thank God we didn't have to contend with that during World War II, or we'd still be withholding bombs.
Admiral Lyons, to me, you were a national hero and a treasure, and I wish there were more like you willing to speak your mind at this point. It's really, really amazing. I want to thank you for being our guest here today on Take Aim. Let me give you one last chance if there's any other final thoughts you would like to offer.
Well, yes, there's one that's been in the papers today. The Pentagon has approved women in combat.
Yes.
I got to say this. There are many viable roles for women in the military. Combat is not one of them. In a country with over 310 million people, of which about 150 are men, why do I have to take women and put them in combat to meet somebody's social agenda? This makes no sense to me.
And that's what you see going on here is just sort of social agenda politics.
You have that right. We saw it with the removal of the don't ask, don't tell.
Right.
I see this as debilitating and affects our overall military morale.
But yet no one on active duty is willing to either give up their career.
Well, I think the Marines objected to it, but they got clamped down. Again, it's the atmosphere, the mentality of political correctness. And, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood has a plan. It is to institute Sharia law in the United States in place of our Constitution. And the way they call it, the stealth jihad. And in their own words, to destroy us by our own miserable hands. And they're making quite a amount of inroads, as you're witnessing today.
And very few have the courage really to stand up and say anything about it because they don't want to be accused of Islamophobia.
You're an Islamist and so forth.
Islamophobe.
You've got to stand up for America and for what we believe and stand for.
Well, our guest again today has been a retired Ambassador James Lyons, James Ace Lyons, Jr., 36-year Navy veteran, former Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, and U.S. Senior Military Representative to the United Nations. It's really been an honor and a pleasure to have you on our show, Take Aim. Admiral, thank you so much again for your service to the country and for spending this hour with us here on Take Aim.
Well, a pleasure to be here, and keep charging.
Will do. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Right.
So long.
All right.